So yesterday we gave a little bit of a hakdama to issues of din in general, and we talked about how the concept of din is both the same and probably distinct from that which is shared with all humanity, because the idea of the mitzvah of din that we find by B'nai Noach to a certain extent is identical maybe to the mitzvah that we have of din for ourselves, and at the same time the mitzvah of din that we have is presumably of a different nature on the spiritual level and possessed of Kedusha and other goals as well. Say Baruch Shekivanti, I mentioned yesterday that it seems that the machlokus between the Rambam and the Ramban was that we find in the context of din may perhaps be l'shitasun, that we find in the context of Jewish din, that the two different machlokas by Bnei Noach din and by Jewish din may be the same machlokas. Question of whether the substance of the mitzvah is to deal with the issues people are fighting about, which may be the Ramban's perspective in both, or is it mostly to keep people behaving, which may be the Rambam's perspective in both. So I mentioned yesterday those two machlokas could perhaps be linked, and that wasn't an observation I've seen pointed out elsewhere. I was at a meeting yesterday with Rav Neuberger, and I mentioned this. He said that he'd also thought of the same point, and that was what he discussed yesterday in the shiur. So, Baruch Shekivanti, that perhaps there is this interesting link between the two different presentations of the Ramban and the Rambam, which really is striking, because one could have thought that the Machlokas Rambam and Ramban by Din B'nai Noach, where it's much more of an explicit machlokas, that there the question is just how do we define the B'nai Noach version of din? To what extent is it the same or different as what we have? But maybe that's not the machlokas. Maybe the machlokas is just in general what din is about, and we really look at them both through the same lens, which is a very interesting idea. So then we discussed a little bit more about the nature of that concept. We made a few other observations. If you had a chance today, I added the list to the tour, so if you wanted to read inside the tour's whole drasha about the nature of din and the importance of din. And today, let's focus on the question for a moment on the concept of dine mamonos b'shlosha, the idea that a monetary dispute requires three, and why should it require three? So in order to frame the question about that, so let's ponder for a second the whole nature of asking shaylos about anything. So this is a topic, as we mentioned yesterday, is actually a topic from this past Shabbos Sileini. In Parashas Shoftim, so there is a very important pasuk on a couple of different levels. The pasuk in the first aliyah of Parashas Shoftim tells us that if it should happen that you have something in Torah you don't understand, ki pala mimcha davar, something that's too wondrous for you, something that's just too mysterious, you're not sure how to observe the dinim of the Torah, so what should you do? This is Perek Yud Zayin in Sefer Dvarim, Pasuk Ches, Ki Yipolei Mimcha Davar LeMishpat. If there is something that you don't understand, Bein Dam LeDam, Bein Din LeDin, Bein Nega LeNega, Divrei Rivos B'Sharecha, V'Kamtov Alisa HaMakom, you should get up and you should go to the place Asher Yivchar Hashem Elokecha Bo. Go to Yerushalayim to ask a shaila, essentially. Uvasta la kohanim halevim, v'yaha shofet asher yeh b'yamim ahem, v'darashta v'yigidu lecha es devar hamishpat. Es devar hamishpat. You should go to the kohanim, the levim, the shofet, whoever it is, and ask the question, and you will have to listen to what they tell you. Because the next pasuk goes on to say, v'yasisa, Alpi hadavar asher yagidu lecha min hamakom ahu asher yivcha Hashem v'shamarta la'asos kechol asher yarucha. The pasuk continues. It's already now the fourth pasuk. Alpi haTorah asher yarucha v'al hamishpat asher yomer lecha taseh v'osasim hadavar asher yagidu lecha yomer nusmol. So this is a very important pasuk, essentially telling us that if we're not sure how to follow the Torah, so we should go to the rabbinic authority, whoever that's going to be, and they are going to instruct us what to do, and that creates binding authority. We're obligated to follow what they say. Now the Rambam, if you got a chance to see, was on this morning's list, the Rambam in Hilchos Mamrim, the very beginning of Hilchos Mamrim, the Rambam has a very important position where he says that based on this last pasuk that we just read, the pasuk of Lo Sasser, so you see that there is binding authority to the rabbinic group, and therefore, that's why they can make Gzeros and Tarkanos, that's why they can make new dinim, what we call dinim drabanan. And this was a point of great controversy, just a little bit of background here. The Ramban, at great length, the Ramban takes issue with this. He says he doesn't think this is true. He's got a couple of problems with this, which you won't go into in all detail right now, but just so you're aware. Ramban says that this, first of all, is not necessarily clear from the pasuk. That we have, let's say, for example, to look at the American model again, so we have different branches of government in America, theoretically. Right? Except theoretically, we have a separation of powers. At least that's the way it's supposed to be. So we're supposed to have an executive branch and a legislative branch and a judiciary branch. So the ideal is that the laws are made by the legislative branch, but they don't get to answer the questions about them. They just make them. If there is a question as to how the law should be applied, so that goes to the judiciary. And the judiciary, they're only allowed to answer, theoretically again, at least ideally, they're only allowed to answer what they think the law is. They're not supposed to tell you what they think the law should be. That's the legislative branch. Legislative branch, they can tell you what they think the law should be, and they can pass that law. But the judiciary, theoretically, if they think the law should be something else, that's not their job. That's called legislating from the bench. They're supposed to just tell you what they think the law is, even if they don't think that that's what it should be, or even if they think it should be something more. So the Rambam's essentially telling us that this pasuk gives the Beis Din both legislative and judiciary authority, that they have the right to interpret the Torah, and that's binding. And they also could say, and you know what, we think we should have another law. We think there should be a din d'rabbanan, that there should be more added to this, and they have the right to do that as well.
Who else would have the other branch if not the d'rabbanan?
So that's a good question. Probably no one. So probably the Ramban's objection is not so much that it should be someone else with this authority, but that the context doesn't make it really obvious that that authority exists. The Rambam is saying, we know this authority from this pasuk. But if we read the flow, the four psukim we just read together, so what was going on, you don't know how to interpret the Torah. Something is, you have a din in the Torah, you don't know what it is. So you go to the authority, and they have binding authority to tell you. So maybe that's just a judiciary role. That's just the same thing as if the Constitution isn't clear, and the Supreme Court gets to tell you what it means, but they're not supposed to, I keep emphasizing that theoretically, they're not supposed to tell you what they think it should be, they're supposed to tell you what they think it is. So maybe that's all that's going on here. That's a part of the Ramban's problem. Ramban also has a problem. He says that we know that halacha, we distinguish in practice between Torah law and rabbinic law. Right? That for the most famous example, we're machmir on dinim and ha-Torah, and we're mekel on dinim drabanan when there is a safek, when we're not sure what the story is. So he asks the Ramban, according to the Rambam, it all comes from this pasuk in the Chumash. So what right do we have to distinguish? What right do we have to be makel if it's all an Isser Ben HaTorah? Not to light Hanukkah candles, it would seem, would be a violation of an Isser Ben HaTorah. We should say, Sofet Toraisa Lahachmir. So there's a whole discussion about this. Maybe we'll have an opportunity to follow this up on a different occasion. But just to know for now that this pasuk is the source of the major debate as to how far its scope goes. Does it actually extend to creating new takanas as well? That was the view of the Rambam, and others disagreed. There's also quite a lot of debate about the end of the pasuk. The pasuk says you shouldn't deviate from that which they tell you, not to the right or to the left. So what does that mean? That's not a political or religious identification left or right. That is a much more recent development since the French Parliament. That's not the way the Torah talks, left and right. So what does it mean when the Torah uses the term left or right? So if you look at Rashi, very, very famous Rashi, and a very confusing Rashi, because Rashi says, "Afilu omer l'chal yamin shu small, v'al small shu yamin." That even if they're going to tell you left is right, and right is left, you still listen to them. Rashi is quoting from the Medrash, Rashi is quoting from the Sifra. So that Rashi is a source of a lot of heated debate. Because what does it sound like Rashi is saying? What does it mean to say left and right and right and left? Even if they're wrong, that's what it sounds like it means. Now that's a big problem, because that doesn't actually seem to be the case. Rav Schechter often mentions that the novelist Herman Wouk taught in Yeshiva University at one point, and that he would say that his novel, The Cain Mutiny, is based on a Rashi in Chumash. And Reb Schechter goes on to say, he thinks it's not the pshat in the Rashi. It's this Rashi that he understands to mean that authority is right no matter what. And that's what Rashi does sound like. And there are others besides Tamaruk who also understood it like that. But it's very difficult to say it like that because we know it's not true. We have a whole Masechta called Horius, where the Masechta is all about what to do if the Beis Din HaGadol, which we'll talk about in the context of our Mishnah also, if the Beis Din HaGadol makes a mistake. And the first Mishnah in Horius, the very first Mishnah, tells us that if Talmud Chacham knows that the Beis Din issued a wrong psak, mamish a wrong psak, so then you're not supposed to listen. And you are personally responsible if you do listen. The din of the Torah is that if the Beis Din gives the wrong psak and the Jews all do the wrong thing, so they don't have to bring a korban if they depended on the Beis Din's psak. The Beis Din instead brings the Sanhedrin brings the korban. But if you knew they were wrong and you did it anyway, then it's your fault. So it sounds like, pretty clearly, that if you mamish know it's a wrong psak, you're not supposed to listen. So there's a lot of discussion that circles around this Rashi, and there's a lot to say about it. It's also maybe a future topic, but again, just important background to what's going on here. Rabbi Chanan Wasserman has long essays about topics of rabbinic authority in his Sefer Kovet Shiurim. There's a separate section called Kutcher's Divrei Sofer. So there he mentions the possibility that maybe what this Rashi is telling us, and what this Drasha, this Medrash that Rashi quotes, is telling us, is not that if they make a mistake, you still have to listen. But what it means is that we know that sometimes the Chazal have the authority to knowingly contradict the Torah. And the most famous example is, let's say it's Rosh Hashanah, and it falls out on Shabbos. So as far as the Torah is concerned, you blow shofar on Rosh Hashanah, no matter what day it is. But Chazal made the rule that we shouldn't blow shofar on Shabbos. And we shouldn't take a lulav on the first day of Sukkot if that's Shabbos. So that rule basically overrides the Torah. And the Gemara says in Yevamos that they're allowed to do that. Yesh koach bidei chachamim la'kor davar min ha-Torah b'shev al tasa. Another fascinating topic. Maybe this should be a Sunday track to come back to all these themes of rabbinic authority to explore in a little more detail. It's not a bad idea. Maybe we'll consider doing that in future Sundays after Yom Kippur. But in any event, that's a din that we know about that exists. So what's the source for that din? How do we know that Chazal had even that much authority? So some suggest maybe that's what this Rashi is telling us. Not that they made a mistake. If they made a mistake, then Taka, we don't follow them. That's what Horius is telling us. But let's say they didn't make a mistake. They intentionally contradict the Torah. They know that the Torah says that we should blow shofar on Rosh Hashanah. But like the Rambam is saying, this Pasuk is telling us also that they can make new laws. And those new laws, we know from the Gemara, that can also override the Torah itself. So maybe that's what the Pasuk is saying, that even if they tell you, don't blow shofar on Shabbos, and you know that according to the Torah, you should blow shofar on Shabbos, it's still binding the fire. Okay? So far, so good? So one important concept, in addition to all of these debates swirling around what's going on here, but we see that there is this concept in the Torah of asking the Shaila and binding authority. And if you had a chance to see the Sefer Achinuch on this morning's list, so the Sefer Achinuch in interpreting this din of Lo Sasser, Sefer Achinuch has an often quoted passage where he seems to say it's not just about the Beis Din HaGadol, it's not just about this clearly defined authority, but it's even today, whoever the Chachamim are, what they say will also have this binding authority that we will have to listen to. So this is a necessary introduction for what I want to talk about today, because we know that we have a concept of asking shailas in general, if we don't know what the halacha is, and we have a concept of rabbinic authority. We have a concept that once we get the answer, so we're supposed to listen. As we alluded to a few minutes ago, that can be a little bit complicated, because you also have to bring into it your own knowledge that if you believe the answer to be absolutely wrong, so then that's a problem. But we also bring into it a lot of humility, and we assume that sometimes the answer might be surprising to us. And that's because we don't fully know all the issues. We're not fully acquainted with the sugya. We're not fully experienced with the material. So that seems to be at least what Rashi is saying, that if we would have thought the opposite should have been the answer, we would have thought that it's left is right and right is left, we would have thought it the other way around, and the answer is surprising to us because we're not at the level to fully understand the issue, okay, then we still have to listen. So what seems to emerge is, in general, that there is a concept of asking a shayla and binding authority, and that really goes to the fact that you are obligated to follow the Torah as you know it to be true, and if you don't know the answer to a question, which can often happen, then intellectual honesty requires you to find an authority who you believe does know the answer, does have the background necessary to fully address the issue, and then that becomes something that is obligatory on you. Now, contemporary Shaila, there is a discussion in post-game. Do we say, like the Sefer HaChinuch is suggesting, that there's an obligation to follow what he says, what the Posek says, because of Lo Sasser, like the HaChinuch sounds? Or do we say that maybe it comes from somewhere else? That's how some of the Sfarim write, that essentially there is somewhat of a commitment, that when you ask a Shaila expecting to get an authoritative answer, so maybe is that some kind of a neder, or is that some kind of a personal commitment to follow the answer that you get? There's an extensive discussion, also worthy of returning to in more detail. It's maybe not a good idea. We'll have maybe a Sunday track about this for a little while. But that's our question in general, how exactly we understand why it should be binding when you get an answer, but we have such a concept. So because of that, so we could ask the following question. So why do we have a Mishnah, the first words of our Mishnah telling us, Dine Mamanus Vishlosha, that monetary issues are adjudicated by a Bezdin of three? So why is this different than any other area of the Torah? If I have a Shaila in Kashrus, so I go to one rabbi, he answers my question. So on the one hand, maybe it's binding, maybe it isn't, that's what we just discussed a second ago, but on the other hand, I don't have to go to a Bezdin. So why is it that if you have a monetary issue, the Mishnah seems to be telling us that requires a Bezdin? Now, parenthetically, this either helps or doesn't help, depending on how you want to interpret it. It's worth noting, while we still have Parsha Shoftim open in front of us, there's a often quoted comment of the Vilna Gaon, that the pasuk here, the first pasuk we started with, ki pala mimcha davar l'mishpat, something that's too astounding for you. The pasuk goes on to say, bein dam l'dam, bein din l'din, u'bein nega l'nega, bein nega l'nega. So what is the reason to give these three categories? Why is the Torah giving you these three kind of random sounding examples?
Yes. Sorry? It's a little bit more complicated. You talked earlier of an extra one.
I mean, these are things that are examples of complicated
things. Very complicated.
It could be. Why do I need three separate examples of complicated things? That itself is complicated. One for each judge. Learn how to dine from each one, from each example. That's a nice one. That could be. That would definitely be a big fetish. What do you want it to come in?
Like 7 to 9.
Yeah, it quotes the Vilna Gaon on this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's like different degrees in area halacha.
Exactly.
Right,
so the Vilna Gaon has a comment over here, which Shapter and others often quote, that this represents three different areas of halacha. Bein dam ladam is midah, din ladin is koshin mishpat, uvein nega lanega is taras. So who cares? Three separate categories. So that shows you that there are different areas of halacha which sometimes have different rules, which is something that we find throughout halacha, that there are different rules for different areas of halacha. Kachin has its own rules. Mamanus has its own rules. So this could be reflective of that idea that there are categories in halacha. This is not all of them, as Shapiro also comments. There's about six different categories. It would be nice if they corresponded to the six starim of Shas. It's not exactly like that, but it's a similar kind of idea, six different areas of halacha. I said dam l'dam, I said that's nida. I left that a little bit vague, because this is also a point other achronim talk about, that nida itself is a discussion, the observance, let's say, of nida b'zman hazeh. So when a woman has a shayla and halachas nidah today, so we know that in the Torah, the Zman Beis HaMikdash, so that had implications for Tumah V'Tahara. So nowadays, when we don't have Tumah V'Tahara function, but we have a marital relationship between a husband and wife, where halachas nidah makes a difference, so is that still a reflection of halachas Tahara V'Tumah? Or is that something else? Is that basically Issur V'Heter? Is that like kashrus, so to speak? So the fact that it's a separate category, that nega l'nega, that's taras. So dam l'dam is mentioned separately. It sounds like hilchos nida nowadays is not about taras, or even in the time of the Torah it had an aspect that's not about taras, that the prohibition to the husband is not a function of anything to do with tumah v'tahara, it's something your day like. Indeed, nowadays you want to look up hilchos nida, you'll find it in your day. So that's another footnote, parenthetical observation about this pasuk. So the pasuk is relevant to what we're discussing here because it shows that there are different categories in halacha, and that's noteworthy that sometimes there are different rules. But on the other hand, as far as asking the shayla, the pasuk just lumped them all together. Right? It doesn't indicate that you do go through a different process as far as asking shaylas on these things. So why is there a difference between asking a shayla about your dishwasher and asking a shayla about a monetary contract? Why should it be? Why should we say dinim amnus pishlosha as opposed to any other shayla? Right.
Generally, dinim amnus have plaintiff and defendant, have two people.
Okay.
So going to one rabbi might be the other one's going to go, I don't accept this rabbi.
Okay, so that's definitely an element. It's interesting, parenthetically, I just mentioned this doesn't really address the question, it's just a semi-related story. They say that Reb Chaim Brisker was asked, why is it that in human nature, empirically, rabbis see through their experience that somebody could come with a shayla about a cow, very expensive cow, lots of potential stakes there, and find that the cow is a trefa, and they lose out on all the stakes, STBAKS, they lose out on all the expensive meat that comes from that animal, and okay, you can handle it, they accept the din, they accept the idea that they lost out on all that money that they could have gotten from this animal. But when you have it in Torah, and it's about a very small amount, and you have Reuven suing Shimon over almost nothing, and Reuven loses, so then Reuven comes out of there swearing like crazy, he wants to kill the dying, he's all furious, he's all upset, but he didn't lose anything near as much as he did the day before when he came to the shayla about his cow. So how come they're able to handle it when they issur v'heter shayla, they get a negative answer, but when they get a dinim amnus negative answer, they get very upset? So I heard two different versions of what he answered. One is a little more cynical than the other. So I'll mention the cynical one first to get out of the way. I would say Chaim Brisker was asked the question. So the more cynical answer, we hope, is not the case, is that I can handle losing the money, they can't handle the other guy getting it. So if the animal is treif, okay, fine, the animal is treif. But if the other guy wins the dollar in the lawsuit, that he can't handle. So that's hopefully not the case about most Jewish people. So the other version of this, a little bit more understandable, is that it's basically taken as a personal judgment. That when the animal is treif, okay, the animal is treif. It happens to be, you're going to lose a lot of money, but it's about the animal. But when you lose, and it's in Torah, so that's how they perceive it, you lose, you're the loser, so they take that personally, and it becomes very offensive, it becomes very hurtful. Okay, so that's the difference between shaylas and issur v'heter and shaylas and dinim amnus. And like Aryeh just mentioned, there's another person involved, so at least the first version of the story took note of that. But we then have to fill in the blanks. Okay, so is that the whole story? So there's another person involved. Let's say the two people agree that this is their rabbi. Let's say they're both part of the same town, and there's one rabbi in the town, so they both agree. Which, by the way, halacha l'maisa might work. But before we get to the halacha l'maisa, so where does this concept that there's some inherent difference in dinei mamonos, where does that come from? On the one hand, on the initial glance, you might think it suggests that dinei mamonos are more chamur. Right? It sounds like, you know, we've seen throughout the Mishnah that the more serious shaylos seem to require more people. It's not exactly in a straight line, but it seems to, let's say if we just compare mamonos to nefashos, that we clearly need many more dayanim involved when it's a more severe kind of issue at stake. That was the other kind of stake. So why is it that mamonos seems to be treated as more chamur? Is that the idea? That maybe we'll say, okay, you have a shayla about your dishwasher, you only need one rabbi. You have a shayla about mamonos, you need three rabbis. Is that the idea? Is it somehow more a chomer? What do you think? Are there any grounds to say that it's more a chomer? Sorry? So that's the point that I already made. So other people involved. So let's flesh that out a little bit. So what if the other people involved? So does that make it more common?
Make it more accepting to the losing party.
Okay. So that's just
one extremist is supposed to use. Two people say I'm wrong and they am wrong.
Mm-hmm. So you definitely could be right about that. And let's explore that in a second. But first, just to address this question, is there any reason to say mamonus is more common? Is there any way in halacha that we find like that? All right.
You have to have a winner. It's not like you can just
play one side has to be given the money. Uh-huh. If you have a question about a
dishwasher, so if it's like a suffix, you don't necessarily get the answer right from one rabbi, then you need to have some sort of resolution here.
I mean, you need to have a resolution, I guess, in both cases.
You need to have a resolution, but it's not, it's like pressing to make sure that someone, and it's also, part of it's also responsibility to be someone's wrong, but.
Okay, so that's a component. Any other, so some other hands up? I want to address the question of Chomer.
Could it be something similar to what we were saying, arguing yesterday about having like a sort of civil society, any kind of people change gender, and so...
Okay, you're saying so the impact of Averos, Ben Adam L'Chavero, has a greater detriment upon society. If this isn't handled, society falls apart. So maybe from that level, maybe it is more Chomer. Could be, right?
I think it's the Bach who says something similar to if you have people running around taking other people's money, then you're not going to be able to have an economy in any civilized society at all. So,
he's saying essentially this is more common, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, there is some element to that, and maybe that's true on one level. Sal?
Because you're choosing between two people, you need to have a fair, I guess, judgment, so you have three people instead of one person deciding.
So that's also, I think, a little bit similar to what Jacob was suggesting, so I want to come back to that point because that's definitely a possible avenue. But before we get to that, just to explore how it could be more chomer, let's say if we just look at it from severity, so...
One last thing is the rabbis are apparently very worried about people's money.
Okay.
Sometimes they'll even be more lenient in certain areas to make sure that people don't lose money, so maybe it's...
Me and Jen, like Torah Chasa, I'm a Mormon, show you show. Okay, it's a broad philosophical idea. We do find that there are certain ways in which it is treated a little bit more chomer. For example, the standard of testimony is different, that when it comes to kashrus, let's say, we have a principle of eid echa neman b'isurim, that we're allowed to trust our mother when she tells us the food is kosher, so we don't require two eidim to come in and ascertain that fact, because we do have this principle that one witness is valid for isur b'heter. And when it comes to monetary issues, so we normally require two kosher eidim, so there are certain ways in which the threshold is a little bit higher. But also one topic that we discussed at length last year is we have the concept of a chazakah, right? We have a chezkas mamon, that if one person has monetary control, monetary possession, so to override that is where you need two eidim. There's a higher threshold between motzim and amuchsa. So maybe there is some element that there is a higher wall that we're talking about when dealing in Mamonos. So that could be. That could be. But there is the other element that a few have noted already, that Jacob and Sal and a few others had called attention to, that maybe this just has to do with the fact that we're dealing with various parties. And various parties, so you could say you need a panel for a couple of reasons. It could be that they're more likely to accept the judgment if there are more people involved. Or it could be that there are conflicting views of who the authority is, as Arya alluded to before. So it's interesting, this could be a model. The third parak of Sanhedrin is called Zebora, which talks about a certain type of bezdin, where you have two litigants against each other, each one selects a dayan, and then together a third dayan is selected. Now, how and why that happens is itself a major sugya, which we'll get to, very important for the current practice of Bate Din today, so we definitely want to address that, so if you'll see it, God willing. But it could be that that's the model, that basically we need to have at least some kind of theoretical representation on each side, that we need to have basically the possibility of one dayan advocating for one party and one dayan advocating for the other party, and then a tiebreaker. So maybe that is built into the model of what happens when you have two parties addressing something. There is an interesting comment in the Meshech Chacham, if you want to look it up. So we all mentioned yesterday, we should look to Parshas Yisrael for inspiration about these issues. So if you look in Parshas Yisrael, the Meshech Chacham has a comment, definitely take a look, it's in Perek Yitches, in the Pasuk Yidalot, that the Torah tells us that Yisrael first criticizes Moshe for the way he is doing the judgments of the nation. And one of the questions he seems to be asking is, why are you judging everybody by yourself as a lone dying? So the Meshech Chachma over there has a discussion about this, and he says that Moshe was allowed to judge as an individual dying. Why? Because the two reasons why you need three dayanim, and neither of them apply to Moshe Rabbeinu. So one of the two reasons he says is that the model is Zebore, what we just said, that you need to have basically at least theoretical advocacy for each side, one and one, and a third in order to be Mafriya, to be a tiebreaker. So that's the general model, so that's what we normally say, Dini Mamnus B'Shosh. And to that, Moshe Rabbeinu responded, but I'm the one who gave the whole Torah, everyone listens to me about everything, I don't have to worry about having two other Dayanim with me. The other reason he suggests over there is also interesting. Take a look over there. He says that the reason you need three Dayanim, the other possibility, is because you want to evoke the Shekhinah. And the Gemara says that the Shekhinah is present when you have three involved in a Din Torah. Now that's another possibility, that maybe there is a greater need for Shekhinah in this case. Now the question is, why don't you need the Shekhinah for every Shiloh? And the truth is, you do. You have a tradition along those lines as well. So it's not clear that that's really a difference. You have to figure out whether or not that's an adequate explanation. Now, the Meshech Chacham himself refers to a Yerushalmi, Yerushalmi in Brachos, which sounds like it's connecting the idea of a Mezumin to a Beis Din, that when you have three for a Mezumin, then you say Elokeinu, because God's presence is there. So too, when you have three for a Beis Din. The Bavli, you have to figure out whether the Bavli really fits. Because the Bavli, I put it on today's Lama Promo section, the Masechet Brachos and Davav, so the Gemara there says that the Shekhinah is present when three are involved in the Din Torah. So that might seem to fit. Well, then maybe we want the Shekhinah, so we want three Dayanim. The problem is, it's not really perfect, because the Gemara then goes on to say that actually the Shekhinah is present also when we have two, and it's also present even when we have one learning Torah. He says, if we know that one person has the Shekhinah, so then why do I need to be told two, and why do I need to be told three? So the Gemara says that two is better than one, because what they say is written down in the Sefer HaZichronos. And three, the Gemara says, you need to be told, because you might have thought, this ties into what we talked about yesterday, you might have thought that Din is not Torah, that Din is just peacemaking, is Shlomo Ba'alma, and that's not where the Shekhinah comes. So the Gemara is telling you that that's also a call to Torah, so the Shekhinah is there too. So that Gemara is very relevant just for us to be aware of for a couple of reasons. First of all, it highlights this idea that Din is not just Shalom in the technical, very practical sense, but it is Torah in the absolute sense. So that's helpful for what we talked about yesterday. It could be relevant to this idea of evoking the Shekhinah, but what seems to come out from that Gemara is that really one also has the Shekhinah. It's just that the Chiddush is that a Beis Din, you might have thought, is not involved in Torah. So that's something maybe is a little bit difficult, I think, for the Meshech Chacham application, but on a couple of levels, that Gemara is certainly relevant to our overall discussion here. So essentially, what emerges, what have we seen so far? I'm a little bit over time already, I apologize, we'll have to continue this tomorrow, but I'll just give you a little bit of direction for tomorrow before we move on to the other topic. So we've seen that maybe it has to do with the fact that maybe Din Mamonis is a little bit more chamer, or maybe at least it's treated as more chamer, as we see from the fact that it needs two Eidim, the fact that there is a Chezkes Mamon that is hard to overcome. Maybe some societal implications are tied in there, as some have suggested. It's David and Ari suggested. Maybe it has to do with the fact that you have another party who has to be convinced. Maybe that's the model of Zeborer Beis Din in general. The Meshech Chachma is connecting that here. The Meshech Chachma's additional suggestion that it has to do with the Shekhinah. We just discussed whether or not that really is a perfect application. But there are a couple of other possibilities as to what might be the significance of three. So God willing, we will try to begin with that tomorrow before moving on to a few other things. Sorry for the overtime and the late start. But that's a shame. We'll discuss that tomorrow. And have a wonderful day.